Yeah, that's logo is pretty orange. I think I may be a little bit biased. I think I like it, but it's a decent bit of orange. We'll use it in more of our long form content, I think. Well, welcome to another T-Rex Talk, everybody. This is day two of the full days of Tennessee Special Session. This is our second live stream talking about the various updates. And a lot has happened. In fact, a lot has happened since 24 hours ago when we were last talking together. And it's a whole bunch of stuff. Now, for those of you who didn't watch the previous live stream, and those of you who haven't been paying close attention to Tennessee, essentially what has happened is the governor called a special session, which is an emergency situation. Legislators get together, and his goal for them was that they would pass red flag laws and some other things in the general scope of gun violence, mental health, and public safety, which does kind of narrow the field down, but those are also super broad topics. So the governor called the legislator back, asked for red flag laws and some various other things in those categories. And to be honest, we thought that there would be general agreement from the legislative session and a whole bunch of the things that he asked for would be passed. There was a tremendous amount of pressure that came down from outside of Tennessee. Gavin Newsom weighed in on what we were doing yesterday. He will be here to fundraise tomorrow. He might apply some pressure while he's here, but mostly I think he's here to fundraise. He's probably going to help some other Democrats fundraise, but I also think he's going to fundraise for himself. That's my guess. But there are call centers set up. There are forum emails coming from every town and various other Bloomberg-associated gun rights organizations, all focused on Tennessee, because post-Bruin, the Supreme Court decision, Bruin versus the New York Pistol and Rifle Association versus Bruin, we have a lot of really good precedent right now in the court system, and we have had a lot of gun control legislation overturned in a whole bunch of states. Red flag laws and mental health stuff is the new kind of end run around that, and Tennessee is really the first test bed for when, how this might go into effect, how this might play out. That's why there's so much national attention on Tennessee right now, and that's why gun rights organizations that are national have spent a lot of time and energy on Tennessee over this summer. So let's talk a little bit, just real quickly, about what a red flag law is, because it's a very generic term that is used to refer to all kinds of different bills. If you go back and watch T-Rex talk, no, it wasn't a T-Rex talk, it was a regular video on the problems with red flag laws, part one. You'll know that there are a bunch of states with red flag laws, and all of them are a little bit different. They have slightly different procedure, they have slightly different penalties, and they have slightly different names. This red flag law is a term that refers to all of them, and essentially it is a preemptive gun control sort of bill, where you preemptively disarm people before they can commit a crime. So you're preemptively punishing people before they are proven to have committed a crime. Now, there are actually procedures in all 50 states to take firearms or vehicles or personal freedom away from people who are demonstrating real active threats, where there is a high burden of proof and you do the due process, you can actually get these things taken away from people. People who have threatened other people often actually go to prison because they have demonstrated that they are willing to go to a certain level of assault or battery or force or reckless endangerment or things like that. But red flag laws don't rise to that level of judicial accuracy. They're a lower civil court thing where general suspicions or some evidence is required, but not the high level of evidence. So when we talk about red flag laws, the left often uses red flag laws as a, don't worry, this is not gun control, it is a kind of a minimal incursion on people's rights, and it doesn't really affect the Second Amendment. The right also uses red flag law as kind of a broad brush to paint anything that is going to confiscate firearms. And I think that the amount of discussion and furor on red flag laws here in the state of Tennessee has actually really affected that term. That slang term might actually be poisoned for Republicans and rhinos. I remember it was not that long ago that Dan Crenshaw was pushing red flag laws as opposed to gun confiscation bills. And I think that he would not do that today, because everybody has pretty much used red flag laws to refer to gun confiscation bills so widely and so publicly for the last couple of years that it is now a completely spoiled term. So there's a number of people inside of Tennessee's legislature who are pro-red flag law because they probably haven't realized that public opinion on that term has shifted. And thanks to you guys, a number of you have sent emails. A number of you watching are in Tennessee. We have a pretty large Tennessee email list, and a bunch of you in Tennessee sent emails to the legislators and addressed this particular issue, told them that you didn't want weapon confiscation, that you didn't want a special session to be called out of nowhere when there wasn't a clear and present danger, there wasn't actually an emergency going on, to take up time and effort and pass bills in a hurry so that there wouldn't actually be the due process to do it properly. And I think that you guys actually had a massive effect on the conversation that is happening in Nashville right now, because it is going a very different way than some people expected. It's going a different way than I thought that it might go. I expected there to be a huge amount of pressure from the outside, and I actually expected a lot more of our legislators to cave to that pressure and to listen to the mob and to pass a red flag law bill because it's not that big of a deal and it isn't really that much of a problem. But there has been, well, backbone may be the wrong term. Several people have shown backbone. In fact, on the live stream last night, I read the names of six people who voted. Essentially, they were supporting a motion to adjourn so that the special session would just be over without passing any legislation. Technically, there were seven. There was a guy who was supporting that motion. He just happened to be out of the room at the time, and he approached the clerk and said, "I want you to record my vote as yes, supporting that bill, even though everybody supporting that motion is going to be punished by House leadership." He wanted his name put on the list, and we have an interview with that guy, Jody Barrett. We'll play that a little bit later in the show. So if you want to hear from Jody Barrett about his reasons for that and what he's doing on the Hill right now and how things are going, and he had some juicy insights to the difference between the way that the House and the Senate are operating. And yeah, so we'll play that interview in a little bit. He is actually our representative here at T-Rex. He is from our district. So it was, I was glad to see that he was, I knew that he would be supportive of ending the special session. I was a little bit surprised that he didn't vote, but I was glad to see that he wanted to make his vote count, even though that was unnecessary. The motion had already failed. Anyone who supported it was going to be punished. He went straight to the clerk and said, "Write me down as one of the people that wanted to end this thing." So that was nice. What else do we have here? We also have a bunch of interesting clips to play of what is happening down there. But essentially, where things stand right now is, even though the governor asked for 18 different things from the legislature, and even though legislators filed over 100 bills, senators and the representatives in the House both filed more than 100 bills, it looks like three or four bills are going to pass. And the reason for that is the Senate has actually stood firm and said, the special session is very short, these things are not super urgent, we're only going to talk about these three bills. And then a fourth one got added for a reason that we will talk about a little bit later. Because both the House and the Senate have to be in agreement, if the House will only hear four bills and they will table all the rest, then the House really cannot make anything happen. They have to just talk about the four bills that the Senate is going to pass. And the Senate has already filed to adjourn because their business is done. They will hear their motion to adjourn tomorrow morning. So when we do the live stream tomorrow, at the same time, same bat channel, 5 p.m. Central, it could all be over. Or the contention between the House and the Senate may have reached epic proportions. Because the other thing that the House and the Senate have to agree on, not just the legislation, but they have to agree on each other's motions to adjourn. One half of the House of Representatives and the Senate, one half cannot just leave and leave the others high and dry. They actually, this is one of the great separations of powers that we have in the United States. They must cooperate to get any business done. And one side can also not just take their ball and go home and just hold the entire process hostage. So I actually think that the way that things are divided up in most states in the United States and in Tennessee, pretty good. It evens things out and it allows for gridlock, which I vastly prefer to reckless, foolhardy speed and haste, which is, you know, kind of what a special session is for. A special session is for an emergency. You set aside other normal rules so you can do things fast. But a lot of the bills that people wanted to pass are exactly the sort of thing you should not pass quickly. They're things that you should be very careful and take very, very slow, measured thought to go over. Now, even as we speak, there are people meeting on the Hill, and we can cut to live footage of what is going on the House. Is it the House floor, or are these subcommittees that are going on?
Yes.
Shall we just check in on our good friend and fantastic slam poetry master, Justin Jones? I'm curious to hear what he's talking about.
Because you say that it's up to local control. Again, police chiefs do not know better than the school board members and administrators who run our schools every day. And what you're saying is that their opinions don't matter, that they can be overridden. And so I think that this bill is very harmful. I think that this bill is very insulting to those who are with our students, who know them, who also care about them. There is a reason why some school districts have decided not to increase police presence. Just last year, we had a student in Hamilton County who was having some behavior issues, tackled and thrown to the ground, a young black student, by a police officer in school. Rather than have an adult, a teacher come and help calm them down. I've seen stories of elementary school students handcuffed in school by police officers, something that a teacher could have helped talk to them because they're trained to de-escalate situations.
That is a very interesting conversation. So that bill, I'll bring it up here. What was the number for that bill, Noel?
SB 7023.
So that is a bill that allows law enforcement agencies to assign law enforcement officers to serve as school resource officers just without going through all of the normal procedure of the school board, because sometimes they need to assign an SRO that the school board hasn't interviewed, perhaps. It's kind of hard to know exactly what's in all these bills because we have captions, there's language, but then there's also amendments. So this is the thing that we're going to talk about a little later in the show. Even though the Senate has limited the bills that they will actually pass to three or four bills, those bills could be amended. Now, we happen to have the language for those bills, and we have the amendments for those bills, so we have a pretty good idea of what the Senate wants to do, and the limitations on those bills is pretty good. I would be happy with those bills passing and nothing else. However, if you are putting two and two together, you notice that the House is still talking about bills that the Senate has tabled. The Senate does not want to talk about this SRO assignment bill, but the House is talking about it. They're kind of playing chicken with the Senate. They're still wanting to pass bills, and they're trying to figure out ways to force the Senate to pick some of these bills back up and hear them. And it's going to be a very interesting thing. It's going to be one of those immovable object and irresistible force kind of situations. But I don't know which one of them is irresistible and which one of them is immovable, because they have both proven themselves to be very movable and resistible at different times on different issues. So we're going to have to wait and see how that plays out. But it is interesting. The issue that we're talking about here is something that I want to bring up. Earlier today, Chris Todd had a bill, which I thought was a super straightforward and simple bill. Throughout Tennessee, we have all these public schools, private schools, charter schools, church schools, etc., and many of them have SROs assigned. Usually these are active police, sometimes deputies from the sheriff's department assigned to specific schools. They are armed. They are the student resource officers that provide security for the schools. And then the private schools often have private security, and it just kind of varies across the board. We've had a number of bills that increase the the budgets for the SROs and change the way that school security is handled so that it is easier for private schools to get private security, so that there's more funding and more grants for these things. And there has actually been a tremendous amount of pushback against the increased school security movement from Moms Demand Action and various other gun control groups. And the best example of that is probably from earlier today when Chris Todd was talking about a bill that would allow off-duty police officers to carry guns inside of schools. I didn't realize off-duty police officers couldn't do it. Apparently, you have to be on duty. If you're a police officer, you must be on duty to carry your service weapon into a school. If you're off-duty, it is a crime. And then also retired law enforcement officers. And this bill actually, as it was being discussed in a committee or a subcommittee, passed. And the reaction from the crowd was extremely negative. This is a thing that would protect children. The entire reason that we're doing this special session is the emergency that was caused by a school shooter. The emotional reason for us to pass gun control laws is to protect children. Here's a bill that would actually protect children. And let's look at some of the different responses from the people after that particular vote.
Privacy and full display!
Fair blood!
We will see you in November, I promise.
We have to follow your rules
here. Do you know how stupid that sounds?
You should all be embarrassed, especially you from Williamson County. You do not represent us.
No, you do not.
Clear the room, please.
Different day.
This is likely to end with kids with disabilities and behavioral issues to be killed because they don't have training.
Amen to that.
They don't know how to de-escalate a situation. I am terrified for what is going to happen because of this.
So that is, I mean, it's not over the top. I've certainly seen more unruly people in the Tennessee legislature. I've even seen more unruly elected officials in the Tennessee legislature. But this is a bill. All it does is let more police officers into schools with firearms, which we're currently doing already. A small subset of police officers can go in there. And that's a pretty fascinating, I think it's just a really fascinating look under the mask of some of these different groups. And it makes it apparent that there's a very specific thing that they want. And it isn't necessarily the same thing that they say that they want. This isn't an issue of public safety for them, because the kind of thing that would demonstrably improve public safety in schools, in public schools, gets that kind of negative response. And Justin Jones, who you heard earlier talking about a bill that would allow SROs to be more rapidly assigned to schools, he's pretty negative on SROs in general. There was something that I wish we'd saved this clip, but it was about 20 minutes before the stream started. He was pushing back on a different bill that would increase SRO presence and SRO spending in schools because cops in schools is bad for minority kids. So this idea that we are doing all of this for the protection of the children kind of falls flat. If anything that would protect the children better is suggested, that takes away from the gun confiscation debate and people react in a very negative way. And there was a lot of focus on this. You can just see the underlying focus on gun confiscation peek out in a whole bunch of different ways. So one of the things that I would say the spiciest stuff that we saw in the debate on the floor was probably when they were talking about the rules. And there were three people in particular who had broken a whole bunch of rules earlier this year and been punished for it, who were the loudest at saying that we don't actually need rules to get stuff done. But some of the rules that were passed into effect were no yelling and no signs. And
no insulting other reps.
Yeah, some people took particular, like they took that personally. Not sure why. The sign rule has actually already been done away with, because yesterday there were some folks with signs. I don't think they were being particularly unruly, but they were waving their signs. These are small paper signs, because you are allowed to carry small paper signs in normally. And the new rules that are in place for this special session don't even allow the small paper signs. They were waving their small paper signs. They were escorted out. They went straight to the ACLU. The ACLU sued the General Assembly of Tennessee on behalf of these three plaintiffs. They actually got a judge's ruling, and so now the little paper signs are back. And one of the paper signs that I saw a bunch of them holding was, I'm trying to remember the exact wording, but it was either this sign or this piece of paper is less regulated than a gun. So there's this very much focus on guns, even though the issue that we're theoretically talking about is public safety, protection of children, and mental health. And also, the sign is not technically true. If she had had that piece of paper in her pocket, it would not have been regulated at all, just like the gun that she would be allowed to have in her pocket. Also, those rules only pertain to a very small part of Tennessee, and she can take that sign anywhere else in Tennessee. She can take it to all sorts of public buildings. She can take it to schools. She can take it to post offices. She can take it all kinds of places that guns cannot go. She can sell that piece of paper. She can give that piece of paper to minors. So saying that that piece of paper is less regulated than firearms is crazy. She can make a smaller version of that piece of paper without filing new paperwork with the ATF, just for example. She can, it's kind of silly. But it just kind of shows that this argument is emotional, not logical. And this argument really is centered entirely over weapon confiscation, not public safety. And we were talking a little bit earlier about just how one-dimensional a lot of these political issues have become. And I believe that this is true on many fronts. It isn't just the left that has made everything pretty one-dimensional. On the right, we have kind of done this too. I wanted to answer some questions from last week. People were asking what I thought about Brandon Herrera's announcement that he is running for office in Texas, the 23rd District of Texas. And a bunch of us have a very one-dimensional focus on this particular channel. We like guns, so politicians who are pro-gun freedom are good guys, and politicians who want less gun freedom are bad guys, regardless of their other positions. But people are very complicated, and there are folks who are really good on certain issues and bad on other issues. So I think that it is really important that we weigh people very carefully. Brandon Herrera is a great example. I really like his gun policy, and I haven't talked to him about any of his other stuff. I don't know where he is on his other things. Now, I have a really good feeling about Brandon Herrera because he really likes Ron Paul. And if he just went to the Tennessee or the Texas legislature and voted no on everything like Ron Paul, he would be a phenomenal representative. That's all that he would need to do to be a tremendous, tremendous step up. I will say, I have a little bit of inside baseball on that particular race, too, because I lived in San Antonio for 4 years, and I know Tony Gonzalez a little bit, and I know some of Tony Gonzalez's backers. So it puts me in an interesting position. But I would vote for Brandon Herrera at this point, even though where I used to live is not in the 23rd District. So let's, as we think about political issues and the need for political reform and all of the stuff that needs to be changed in the state of Tennessee or Texas or federally, let's try not to be as one-dimensional as some of these gun control groups. Let's try to be really focused on the bigger picture. Now, ultimately, I think that there is one-dimensional is probably the wrong term now that I think about it mathematically. Two-dimensional. There's probably a two-dimensional scale where we could grade everything on. And I believe that the best way to do that is to think about what is going to make the civil government larger and more powerful, and what is going to make the civil government smaller. And there are ways that you could pass a bill that ostensibly does gun freedom, where the government actually hands out gun freedoms, but in a way that makes it the government's responsibility to do so, and starts with the presupposition that it is the government that grants rights and it is the government that regulates and manages these things, as opposed to the rights of private citizens. So if we were going to have a simple two-dimensional scale, it would be much better to tie it to that particular issue. How do we get government to do government's job? How do we get government to stay inside of government's jurisdiction and then do government's job really well inside of that jurisdiction, as opposed to just all these little pet issues that go back and forth? Commenter here says, Brandon is running on a platform of actually finishing the AK-50 if he wins. That is a phenomenal campaign promise, but I haven't seen him make that directly, so we'll wait and see. Is there any chance we get breakdowns on other battleground states? So I would love to know what is going on in other states, but I know about Tennessee because I live here, and I've been working in and around Tennessee politics for a little while now, and I have a really somewhat obsolete picture of Texas because I used to live there. I would love to find other guys who are doing this kind of work in other states and talk to them on this show, because Oregon is a battleground state, Washington is a battleground state, Illinois has been one for a long time. Hawaii has been one of the most restrictive states when it comes to gun rights, and I think that people are willing to re-examine some of Hawaii's policies now, and I think that Hawaiians are actually really considering being a more, what's the right word? A more independent state based on things that are happening in Hawaii right now. I think that there will be some movement in Hawaii that will be really interesting to see. So I would love to figure out who is doing the work and figure out what lessons we can learn from them as we move forwards. But I think that there's a lot of lessons that we can learn from here in Tennessee, because this is really the first big national all-hands-on-deck push for red flag laws post-Bruin, and it's happening in a very red state with a Republican supermajority, and there was this idea that the special session was going to ramrod a whole bunch of stuff through that otherwise would not have passed because a governor was pushing it who was not up for re-election, and it was an emotional issue that had completely charged the entire populace, and the mainstream media was going to make it happen. And I am pleasantly surprised that the Tennessee legislature has done far less than was expected of them, and that was a really good call. So, what should we do next, Noelle? We have a whole bunch of interesting clips. We have an interview with Jody Barrett. Let's talk about mental health for just a moment. The other thing that I think that we need to do is figure out what we mean when we talk about mental health, because mental health is a driving factor for a lot of these conversations. Mental health is the excuse for a whole lot of these changes. The impending or present mental health crisis, depending on who you're talking to, is a reason to make massive changes to the way that we do law. And yet mental health is just a super fuzzy thing. Are we talking about doctors who specialize in these things? Are we talking about psychiatrists? Are we talking about psychologists? Are we talking about therapists? Are we talking about fake therapists on the internet? There's all kinds of things contributing to mental health. So when we talk about allowing mental health professionals to take away people's guns or take away people's rights to privacy or take away people's rights to freedom by putting them in various types of institutions, we should figure out what exactly we are talking about. Also, very few full-time institutions really exist anymore. And one of the things that I think is confusing to this debate is we have in Tennessee, like many states do, legislators who are old enough to remember when we used to have asylums. So they're probably thinking of a totally different type of mental health professional than young Gen Zers on TikTok who are calling for mental health professionals to have more power. It's going to be really interesting to try to find some experts in this particular field, because there have been some significant political and cultural battles fought over what is mental health and what is mental illness. And even this idea is going around now, largely on the left, that your mental illness is not a disability, it is just a different ability. So you don't cure it, you don't heal it, you fly that flag proudly. And those are some of the same people who think that we should disarm mentally ill people. So it's a very confusing thing, even on the left. I don't think anybody has really figured out what they want to do. The cool thing for people on the left is, if you want a bill that disarms people, you know that that bill is really only going to be used against people who are currently armed. And people who are currently armed are largely conservative, so it ends up being, you know, a sort of a self-selecting thing. Not exactly equitable. But we have some clips from people talking about people who are mental health experts talking on the floor. This is the other thing that I think is really fascinating about the normal legislative process. As you file bills, you will go out and you will find experts who can talk to the other legislators in support of your bill. And if you find out that there's bad bills coming, you go out and you find experts in that field to come and testify against the legislation, because They have expert knowledge. In a special session, there's very little time for that, but there were a few experts who showed up, and let's play a couple of those clips from yesterday.
I think the general problem with this bill is lowering the standard in hopes that we're going to catch more folks before they commit an act. And so even if we change that word slightly and pick a new word, keeping predicted in, this idea that we're going to anticipate problems before we have evidence of any kind to use this severe intervention is going to be problematic. And so we might find another synonym that's slightly different, but perceived, predicted are both problematic, and they're both going to cause the confusion and the backlog and overburdening of an already under-resourced system.
Chairman Jernigan.
So I think I get what you're saying. So you're saying that maybe even a word predicted or whatever interchangeable word they want to use. Not every doctor is going to use the word or use predicted the same. And some doctors are going to see or look at it, I guess, in a liberal way or in some in a conservative way, some in a conspiracy way and some in a very scientific way. So your issue is that the definition is all over the board instead of a direct. Is that correct?
Right. It's okay. Creating a new standard, and I realize it seems like a small change, but it's going to have huge impacts on how we practice, and that's one of the unintended consequences.
This is a very complicated issue, and I want you to remember that legislators are not the experts. Now, legislators should be very careful when they rely on the experts, but it's very important to remember that those are regular guys like you or me, and they get elected by regular guys like you and me, sometimes actually you and me, and they need to very carefully weigh all of the different testimonies that they receive on these issues. A lot of the legislators are not lawyers, and so they will write bills that expand the mandatory reporting requirements. I think that was the main thing that they were talking about there. It said that you will now have to report a general threat as opposed to a specific threat, which, you know, when we're talking, general and specific are kind of wishy-washy terms. Legally speaking, they aren't. And in terms of medical reporting requirements, that has a massive change on the way that you ethically do medical stuff and legally what you are going to do when there's a specific or general threat. I think I heard some general threats from people who were protesting the passage of Chris Todd's bill. I think they were generally threatening, but I'm not sure if that counts because, I don't know, I'm not a doctor or a lawyer or a psychiatrist or a fake TikTok therapist. So, yeah. Someone says here, lawyers write the bills and Congress votes on it. Generally, that is true. And in the state of Tennessee, we have an entire legal team that works for the Capitol. The legal team vets the bills to make sure that they are legally compatible with all of the code that is currently on the books. But in a special session, Noel, I don't know if there's time for them to read all of those 100 bills and actually vet them appropriately. I'm pretty sure that they saw those bills on Friday or Monday, the same time that everybody else did. So we are passing unexamined code when we pass some of these bills. Now, fortunately, the Senate has really focused the efforts on three or four bills, and they have really tightened things down a little bit as far as what they wanted to do. And in a real short space of time, you can actually talk about three or four very small bills that don't open up a huge can of worms related to mental health, and you can actually get the legal vetting and you can actually do the experts. One of the bills is really super simple. What it does is it takes the sales tax that is normally applied to gun safes, because we have sales tax in Tennessee, and it removes that so that it's easier for people to afford gun safes. Now, technically, we already did this years ago temporarily, and all that this bill does is take that temporary sales tax removal and makes it a permanent sales tax removal. So that's the kind of bill that a few lawyers look at it, make sure that it doesn't break code. You talk about it for a little while. Like, it probably doesn't need a whole bunch of doctors or lawyers or gun industry people to really weigh in on it. That's the sort of bill that you can comfortably talk about in this tiny space of time that you have in the special session. Speaking of tiny space of time, we have half an hour left. We should probably play the interview with Jody Barrett. So Jody Barrett, for those of you who recently joined the stream, is a representative of House District 69. That's the same area that T-Rex is in, so he's our representative. And I talked to him earlier today while he was in between committees and conversations. So if you're ready to roll that clip, we can bring it up and go through it there. And agreeing to do it live and on camera. And this conversation isn't going to be live, I should say that. We'll play this clip sometime after 5 o'clock when we go live in a very few number of minutes. But the first thing I wanted to point out to folks is last night on the live stream, I thanked the six people who voted to adjourn. And at the time, there were only six that had voted to adjourn, but you actually are one of the seven people who voted to adjourn. Can you walk us through how that happened real quick?
Sure. So it was actually a motion to suspend the rules so that we could take up a motion to adjourn. A resolution had been filed by Representative Brian Ritchie. And the way the session starts, we have to adopt our House rules first. And so we went through that process, which I'm sure you saw all of the hullabaloo about that. And once we had the rules adopted, then this motion had been filed, or this resolution had been filed. And so it was actually a motion to suspend the rules so that we could then turn around and take that up and have a vote on the resolution to adjourn. And I was explaining to you, I was in one of the side rooms over there trying to get something to drink and talking to a few other members. And we heard the bell ring for the vote. And as I stepped out of the side room, I was trying to ascertain what they were voting on, because unfortunately I was not paying that close attention, but the board was all lit up. And so I had to go and talk to the clerk and fill out a piece of paper to have her lodge my vote. I had told leadership and the speaker really for a month or so leading up to this that my district was adamantly in favor of adjournment. And so, you know, I was going to have to vote for it no matter what to represent my district. So it wasn't a big surprise to them. In fact, they had some conversations with some of the other members throughout the day on Monday to kind of see where everybody was. And I didn't get one of those calls because I think they already knew where I stood on it.
Yeah. Things moved pretty fast. They went from very long, slow conversation about the rules and then very long, extended welcoming and honorary sections. Bam, auctioneer mode, making motions. So that kind of took me by surprise. I was listening and writing at the same time, and the tone suddenly shifted. So, your vote.
That's why I got up to go into the side room. I thought we probably had another 45 minutes to an hour. I didn't realize it was going to go that quickly myself. So,
yeah. So special sessions are interesting because it does feel like there's this mix of hurry up and wait. Stuff's got to go super fast, but some people have to wait for a while. And thank you for taking some time to talk to us while it is still the special session.
Sure.
But what are special sessions like compared to regular sessions when you are a legislator?
Well, things obviously move much faster, as you say. You know, typical process to get a bill from filing to the House floor through the committee process is, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, really. Maybe longer if you're going back and forth, or maybe having to bounce through a couple of different committees. But in a special session, the filing deadline was last Friday afternoon. We opened session on Monday evening, and bills were read for the first time or submitted for first reading, and then committees started on Tuesday. And so bills that were submitted to subcommittee on Tuesday are going to be on the House floor on Thursday. So within 3 days, turnaround, really less than a week of filing, many of these bills are going to be on the House floor and being voted on. So, you know, the big thing is this whole entire process in a special session where we're under what's called flow motion, and that's what suspends the rules where things can move so quickly. Is there's just not enough time really for adequate debate. What helps in the regular session process is when you submit a bill and present it for the first time, you get a lot of good feedback from that subcommittee and different stakeholders that come to the meeting and want to comment on your bill. And a lot of times you get some really good ideas and ways that you can tweak that bill and make it better. And so you maybe roll your bill for a week, go work with everybody that has some comments, and then by the time you get back to present it again, hopefully everybody's kind of on board and you have a better product than what you started with. Here in the special session setting, there's not a whole lot of time or room for that. I mean, you can't even, you have to file, I believe, an amendment has to be filed 4 hours before the committee while you're in special session. So, you know, finding the time to actually get an amendment drafted so that you can file it in order to have it heard. It's just, it's a breakneck pace that, you know, it's kind of like anything there in where you are with your business. If you guys were trying to crank things out too quickly, then that's going to raise your error rate.
Yeah, he's got a point there. When we at T-Rex make decisions too fast without all the data because there's a fake emergency, bad decisions are made. When we make hasty decisions because it's a real emergency, bad decisions are occasionally made, but sometimes it's better than no decision at all. But in this particular case here in Tennessee, there is clearly no immediate emergency. Now, there are some things that Tennessee should address and should solve. I was a little bit impressed, negatively impressed, that Memphis ranks so highly on dangerous cities. Memphis is in the top 20 of most dangerous cities in the United States. I thought we would, you know, maybe be in the top 50, but Memphis is no joke. So there's a lot of things that law enforcement could be working on. There's a lot of stuff that we really should try to address. There are significant issues with mental health, and there are very significant issues revolving around some of these different public safety things that we're talking about. But to limit the conversation to a real short amount of time and to make it fit into the narrative that is gun control and gun confiscation and the disarmament of people who are not causing the problem, just in case they ever do cause the problem, and ignoring all the problems that already exist, isn't going to do anything except create more symptoms. And going back to that two-dimensional graph, makes the state more powerful and the police or the people less powerful. As the people become less powerful, we just have a lot less of a say in what the state is doing. So let's go to some questions really quick here. I see a lot of you chiming in. A lot of you are having good conversations with one another while this continues to go on. Noel, would you check on what is happening on the floor or what is happening in Nashville at the moment in case it's something fun, something interesting? We have an incredible focus on mental health, largely focused by activists and then commented on by people who are old enough to remember the good and bad old days of the asylums and demanding that we pass bills to see what is in them and put stuff into effect to see how it's going to turn out. And I was thinking about what that medical health professional was talking about before. Just the resources are already stretched incredibly thin. So forcing more people to be thrown into that system that cannot support them doesn't actually solve the problem. In fact, it actually does a tremendous disservice to the people who are already in the system and already actually need treatment. To take people who are gun owners, claim that they need treatment, and then throw them into the mental institutions, I can see why that would be attractive to a certain political persuasion of person, but it doesn't actually do any of the positive stuff that people claim. And there is one bill that I do want to talk about. This is one of the bills that will be a contentious one. I can pretty much guarantee that this will be one that is talked about behind closed doors. This is a Lamberth bill. And this is one of the bills that the Senate has tabled. And some of the people in the House really want this bill in particular to go through. This is House Bill 7027, and it's a mental health bill. The caption says, as introduced, it requires the state to pay the cost of a court-ordered mental health evaluation and treatment for criminal defendants who have been charged with a misdemeanor and are believed to be incompetent to stand trial or for whom there is a question about mental capacity at the time of the offense. So this sounds like a good idea. If you have people who have committed crimes and you think that they maybe are incompetent to stand trial or maybe there was some mental thing going on at the time of the offense, they should have a mental health evaluation. And since some people cannot afford that, the state should just pay for it. But let's actually find out if those resources are there. Now, Tennessee actually has a fairly large budget surplus at the moment, so it's really easy for the people in Nashville to look at the billions of dollars that they have. Is it billions? Is it? It was hundreds of millions, and it may be billions now. And just decide, we have the money, we can do it. But do we actually have the medical resources to accomplish this? And misdemeanors go pretty low in Tennessee. So we're talking about some pretty insignificant crimes in the grand scheme of things. We're talking about taking many, many hours out of not just some sort of court-appointed psychiatrist's time, but also the transport of prisoners and the delay of actual legal proceedings. We're talking about just a tremendous amount of stuff that has to be done now, even for misdemeanors, before anything can move forward. And if anybody wants to slow things down, if you had, say, a bone to pick with somebody and you got them arrested on a misdemeanor and you were able to suggest that they needed some sort of mental health evaluation because of their abnormally large gun collection, for example, well, now they have a whole bunch of paperwork and they have to be transported to places. And now just a whole bunch of extra steps are in place before they ever actually get to a trial, someplace where they have a opportunity to make their defense and be exonerated. I believe this even has to be done before they can be given bail, or maybe that was a different bill. There are 100 bills, so I may be running a few together. It is actually pretty confusing how many bills they are. The bill that we were talking about earlier from Chris Todd that would allow that would allow off-duty police officers to carry firearms into schools, this unbelievably offensive bill that would allow off-duty police officers to carry in schools. There is a bill almost identical to it, but it has even more restrictions on it. So those off-duty police officers, retired police officers, have to stay up to date on their qualifications and they have to be mentally evaluated. Even that bill is a bridge too far for some of the gun control advocates that are out there. So we got a lot of different stuff to think about, and I really hope that we are able to stick to the Senate schedule of adjourning in the morning, having passed only 4 bills, so that they can get an end to this special session. We can actually finish the 4 bills and everybody can go home. I really hope that there isn't some kind of crazy confrontation tonight. I guarantee that there will be.
Yeah, Kayla is giving us live updates that there's now 2 bills.
2 contentious bills?
Is insisting on, and they're both multi-page horrors. So
okay, 7032. Let me look up 7032 and let's read it here. Oh, this is a Cameron Sexton bill. Okay, this is another ridiculously open-ended bill. As introduced, it requires health insurance carriers, including 10 care providers, to provide mental health services and treatment to the same extent that the carriers and providers provide alcoholism and drug-dependent services and treatment. We would have to see actual language to know what this particular caption refers to. It amends Title 8, Title 33, Title 56, and Title 71, so that is quite a few pieces of code. But this is, again, treating symptoms, and I wonder if it says that this just adds mental health services and treatment to the same level of legal requirements as various other things. Probably without doing, if I had to guess, they probably didn't do all the due diligence that is necessary to determine whether the resources actually exist. And a lot of these mental health services and treatments should really be spelled out, because there has been a very long time to develop some alcohol and drug dependency treatment services. Like, some of these have a very long track record. They've had time to be added to the books very slowly. Specialists have come along and started clinics and applied for the paperwork and so forth. This just says mental health will be done at the same level, with the same amount of money and the same level of support for the same number of people, by the same number of people, basically. It just wills all of this stuff into existence. Yeah, that is a Cameron Sexton bill, so I can see why he's putting a lot of pressure on the people to pass this. Cameron Sexton is the Speaker of the House. And I wasn't planning on getting into some of the stark differences between the House and the Senate. Should we talk about the ways that they appear to be running differently in the last couple of days?
It would be fun. Yeah.
One of them is organized, uh-huh. and one of them is a bag of cats. One of them one of them is not organized. No. So Cameron Sexton is the Speaker of the House. The House has not organized themselves the way that the Senate has. And there's a couple reasons for that. One of them is the Senate is smaller. There are fewer people, and there's a larger barrier of entry to getting into the Senate because there are fewer seats that are available. And so those guys tend to be a little bit more mature, and they've worked a little bit harder, and there's a lot less of them running around getting into trouble. So that is definitely on their side. But the other thing that's interesting is the current speaker in the Senate, the lieutenant governor, his days are numbered. Has he announced when he's going to be stepping down as speaker?
Yeah, at the end of this term, another year and a half.
Yeah, so he's only going to be there for another year and a half, which means that his heir apparent and any challengers are making their moves now. So a bunch of people in the Senate, two in particular that I can think of, are on their very best behavior, demonstrating their very best organizational skills and getting the most stuff done that they can, because that is very important for them at this very moment. Cameron Sexton over in the House is definitely throwing his weight around and punishing people for supporting certain motions and swinging as big a hammer as possible, and yet I don't actually see a whole lot of order coming out of it. So this is a very interesting juxtaposition. You'd expect it to be the other way. You'd expect the power plays in the Senate to result in chaos and the single guy running things with an iron fist in the House to get everybody in line. But it's interesting. Tonight is going to be a very, very, very interesting night for a small amount of people. And it'll have a big effect on a big amount of people. Yeah, are there any other updates that we should read? The Senate is currently remaining strong, according to our folks inside. Yeah, it is a very interesting way. So this bill, 7032, that requires mental health services to be provided at the same level with the same amount of money as drug and alcohol services, is a pretty big deal. There's a ton of money in there. That's pretty fascinating. It is 9 pages long, so we're not going to read it now. Stuff is developing even as we speak. I wish we had an entire newsroom full of people doing the research and the journalism and playing the clips, because we could make this really interesting. A lot more than an hour's worth of material has been generated by people down in Nashville during the hour that we have been speaking. So,
ostrich egg has been
apologized for. I wasn't going to talk about the ostrich egg, but so last night, this is so childish, I actually kind of enjoy it. So the Senate picked what they were going to do, 3 bills. And the reason it became 4 bills is because of the two guys that are jockeying for position. They picked what they were going to do, they did it, and they left. And some people in the House were highly annoyed that they weren't going to get to pass 100 bills. So they got an ostrich egg from somewhere, and they put it inside the Senate chambers and said, "You guys are the ostriches with your head in the sand." So that is, I don't know, kind of classy, but it's meme-worthy trolling at a sort of a low level.
It kind of backfired on them.
It kind of backfired, and they had to apologize for it today. So that is kind of funny. It's a very fascinating thing that is happening right now, and I would encourage you guys to look at some of the news items and to follow the media coverage of this event and compare it to what we're letting you guys know, because this is really a good test case for this particular game plan, an entirely, a genuinely emotionally devastating event, a school shooting that murders children. On the heels of that emotion pushing for an emergency action and pushing for a really fast emergency action and making it about mental health, not about the Second Amendment, not about gun rights, because since Bruin is handed down, the precedent in the courts doesn't really help the gun control message. And then to turn it into this very complicated and extremely partisan conversation about children and about gun violence and about mental health and just apply as much emotional language as possible to the debate. So even the clips that we saw, I didn't mean to pick on Justin Jones as much as we have, but every time we have wanted to play a clip of something, it's him. So, and he would like to talk a lot this special session because this really is his time to shine. He got a huge amount of attention back when he caused some ruckus and some disturbance earlier in April. He was specifically mentioned by Obama, by Kamala Harris, and by Joe Biden. He was mentioned by everybody. He was in the news quite a bit. People came down and fundraised with him, and he fundraised quite a bit himself. And now is his time to shine again in this special session. The special session is about the emergency that he threw a big fit about earlier. So he's trying to talk as much as he can, and he's bringing up very emotional arguments. He's arguing against putting armed guards in schools because of emotional arguments about how it's hard for minority children to have them in there. And so this is a very partisan issue. It's really easy to boil it down to these really simple simple emotional things that certain people on the political spectrum have chosen as just really important points. So much so that the idea of putting more armed guards into schools is utterly incomprehensible or offensive to them when theoretically we're talking about the safety of children. I'd like to point out that the school shooter in Nashville, it is kind of hard to know what all the facts are because the manifesto that she wrote is still being suppressed. The reports on what happened are kind of shrouded in mystery at this point. One of the bills that the Senate has passed has to do with whether or not the autopsy reports on minors become public record or whether they have to be released by the family. That is in some way connected to this issue, but I honestly do not know how, because I'm not sure how that issue arose during those autopsies and during the investigation. But it is pretty widely accepted at this point that the school shooter went to another school first. She had two particular targets. She went to another school first, and because there were guards there, she left and went to the Covenant School. So even with this one particular shooter that we are talking about, the reason, the justification for this special session, we have proof that hardening one location, having guards at one location, saved lives there. And when she went to the other location and there were no protections for the students, murder was done there, even though this is literally the situation that we are trying to avoid. And we can see a situation at the one school where by having armed guards, by having good guys with guns, murder was averted. And in the other place, those protections were not there. Murder was not averted. Murder was not averted until the good guys with guns got there. I will say their response time was tremendous, but you know the saying, when seconds count, the police are minutes away. I was actually shocked at how quickly they arrived. They did a phenomenal job of addressing the situation and moving quickly, but it did take minutes, and seconds counted. So even with all of the evidence that exists, and we're only allowed to see some of the evidence at this point, we're still being asked to make an extremely emotional response to the school shooting. People are still putting pressure on the Tennessee legislature to pass these really hastily written bills. And because we are a pretty disjointed society, like even the Republicans on the House side are still kind of wrangling over issues that I think that we should set aside and wait for the general session to talk about. And I think the reason for this is we have a pretty wide political spectrum, even inside the Republican Party. And I believe you see more of that when you have a Republican supermajority. Like the Democrats in Tennessee, I feel like, are here mostly for comic relief. There really just aren't enough of them to sway policy that much. And so the Republicans in the supermajority feel like they can kind of run the show. There isn't any common threat that they have to unite against. There isn't any common purpose that they have to get together for. They can kind of hang out and do their own thing. And that is one of the reasons that I think that they were really taken off guard by what happened in April. After the school shooting, they were surrounded by protesters from all over. Tremendous national pressure from the White House on down. And I think that a lot of them didn't really expect that. And it really put them off their game quite a bit. I'm actually very encouraged at how well they have resisted that kind of pressure during the special session, even though there is this tension and struggle and, gags with ostrich eggs here and there. They have resisted the pressure a lot better than I thought they would based on what happened in April. In April, I think everybody experienced a kind of cultural warfare that we hadn't seen in Tennessee before. Now, if you watch national news, if you watch what's happening in Seattle, if you watch what's happening in California, if you watch what's happening in some of these other states, this shouldn't surprise you too much. But it hadn't really happened here in Tennessee because we have this Republican supermajority and all of our Democrats, for the most part, I can think of three that maybe this doesn't really apply to. But we have a lot of Democrats that are just really nice, honest people. They would never say that they wish that your children had been killed, because that would be a terrible thing to say. And so when a bunch of people showed up here in Nashville and started screaming at people and saying that they wished that their children had been killed and that their children would be killed if they didn't take action, it was pretty unprecedented to have the White House and various other large national institutions call out Tennessee for being horrible, backwards people. I mean, we get that in jokes, but we do usually don't get that on CNN or directly from the president, Kamala Harris, or the other president, Obama, or Joe Biden. That's his name. Yes, I remembered. And I think that that is something that all of us need to be a little more ready for. This is the way that political discourse works. Everything is now really infused and saturated by what's going on in the culture war, which is the other reason that we have to be really careful about the unintended consequences of really hastily and recklessly applying the mental health label to a whole bunch of stuff, when that in and of itself is a cultural battleground. Using that to justify some of these bills is going to cause a lot of confusion and difficulty. But there is a really interesting thing that happened when they were debating the rules yesterday. There were a number of people who were saying, this is not democratic. These rules are the death of democracy. If you're not going to allow the people to come in here and wave their signs and yell and throw tantrums, you are preventing democracy from happening. And to some extent, I actually agree, because the United States is not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic. We don't want a democracy where 51% of the people decide that we can put the other 49% of the people in camps, or vice versa. We actually want the rule of law. We actually want a constitution that lays out the rights that people have and the limitations that government is placed under. And then we have the legislative processes that are complicated and the division of powers and a very restricted role of government within those powers. That way you don't have to have the terror of a democracy. You don't have to make all of your decisions based on who is loudest or swings the biggest stick or carries the biggest signs. And the crowd that is getting most of their work done by swinging big signs and terrorizing people really don't like the idea of restrictive rules. They would prefer to have democracy in action than a constitutional republic. So I think they actually had a point. That wasn't just democratic jingoism. That wasn't just sloganeering. They may have been onto something. So I think that it is really important that we define our terms very carefully, and then we figure out the standards that we want to live by. So that is where I'm going to end the stream tonight. We've gone a few minutes over. There is stuff still being discussed on the floor. They're continuing to talk about stuff in different committees. I guess we'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow at 5 o'clock, again, we will be here doing a live stream to tell you what happened tonight and what happened tomorrow. It's going to be very fascinating. I think a lot of us are at this point a little bit bored by all of the political and legal and medical and psychological jargon and all the I don't know, what do you call it? Is it infighting yet, or is it just kind of inter-party struggle? Things could get very spicy this evening behind closed doors, and if that happens, they'll probably be pretty spicy in public tomorrow. So we will keep you posted. We're going to continue to watch what's going on. We're going to continue to read the legislation and the amendments and see what we can discover for you. But thank you so much for allowing us to do this. I forgot to mention earlier, we are in the warehouse of T-Rex. We are in the warehouse because the warehouse crew gets their work done relatively quickly. Not relatively quickly. They get their work done very quickly. So this is a pretty quiet place for us to work when we're starting a 5 o'clock live stream. And it is the product that you see behind us and the fact that you guys buy that product that allows us to do things like the lobbying that we have done, the study that we have done, brought along people to help run the live stream and actually figure some of this stuff out and report on it. So you guys are making all of this possible. And next week we are launching a chest rig. A bunch of people have asked about the chest rig. When can they know more about the chest rig? Will I leak the chest rig? I acknowledge the existence of the chest rig, and you guys will see it next week. And we will have more news for you about Tennessee's red flag laws, which I think are dead, and Tennessee's other mental health laws, which may not be dead, and Tennessee's overall special session. I really hope it ends tomorrow. We will tell you if it does. We will find out if we'll be back on Friday tomorrow, and there may be chest rig leaks tomorrow, possibly, maybe. We'll see.